Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
We have got sort of 10 minutes or so, really, for questions. So I'll just I'll throw it open. As I say, the questions may well be more specifically aimed at a particular presentation or an individual speaker, but there may be kind of more general comments or questions which you might want to make, which you feel kind of perhaps may be more appropriate for a number of speakers. So it's at this point I kind of take a deep breath and hand over to you to see whether there's anything particularly forthcoming that you'd like to say. Or not. Ah, we have our first couple. If you wouldn't mind just standing so the camera will catch you and also just saying who you are and where you're from. Thank you.
Me first, yeah?
Yes, if you could stand as well, please. Sorry, just so the camera can catch you. But you don't need to kind of completely stare at it, but that's fine. Thank you.
Morning, everybody. My name's Annie Doyle. I work for Supporting Professionalism in Admissions. I think we've had some very interesting talks. Thank you to the panel. I was struck by something Professor Alcock said about there being too many providers of HE throughout the UK. I think he said he'd gone to the Northwest to establish a part of provision, and that was your observation. I'm just interested, really, in the panel's thoughts on this aspect of our UK HE provision. Are there too many? What will happen in the future? What do you see as the shape, perhaps, of HE? We've talked a bit about... I like the independent label that was mentioned by Study UK. Do we see more independent providers and fewer of what we might class as the traditional HE providers and perhaps others that don't exist at the moment starting to come into the market?
That's really helpful, and I think kind of, you know, it touches on as you mentioned, kind of just, you know, what the future shape and size might be and breakdown. There was also a comment from Sue had her hand up as well at the front. Do you want to still ask your question? Just wait for the microphone if you wouldn't mind again saying who you are.
Hi, Sue Hindley, Chair of Study UK but Principal of ETEMS Graduate School. I mean, one of the concerns I have in terms of dealing with government is this difficulty that we have in terms of looking out at businesses. We you know, this one year at a time planning viewpoint is something that is going to prevent anyone, let's face it, from really investing to create a level playing field with private sector providers. I welcome your thoughts.
Great. I think two really interesting and in some ways kind of complementary questions, because one is sort of, you know, what might the landscape look like? But that will, to a large extent, be influenced by, you know, planning and organisation and anticipation from government and the kind of the quality and timeliness of their planning. I think there are things that in some respects all speakers might have views on. So I'll start with Andy and just kind of work down, really.
Well, let me start with are there too many providers? I would say no. I mean, the real way to answer that question is what's going to happen to demand? You know, how will demand kind of either grow or change? And I think actually it will probably grow and change. So are there too many providers? No. The answer might be, and I think kind of, you know, I don't want to preempt your kind of comments, but the answer might be there might be too many providers of particular types of higher education. and I think to go back to what I've just said about, you know, growth and change in demand, I think, you know, apart from last year, and we were already beginning to see slight recovery in numbers, and again, I'm only talking about a particular type of higher education in that. You know, if you look across the OECD, the demand for higher education and beyond the OECD continues to rise very, very steeply, actually. And so, you know, that suggests that the kind of, you know, the growth and proliferation of types of provision and provider will continue. For policy to get its head round what that kind of proliferation in both demand and provision is a very, very different question. I mean, my whole premise was that they're kind of behind the curve on that. But, you know, and in a sense, this is the big issue is kind of, you know, who's got the business models to cope with that? Whether you're talking about niche, specialist, independent, just to list three random phrases we've already heard today, or MOOCs, technology, you know, joint venture, you know, I mean, there are a myriad of different ways that we can cope with it. But I think more demand, more provision, more different types of provision. That's how I see the next 10 years in the UK and beyond.
Yes, indeed. I was really saying that there's too many of a traditional variety. Yeah, but also, I think we've just got to accept that I was just also speaking about the home market. Clearly, there's a huge international market, and it's a rapidly growing international market, but we appear at the moment, or at least the government appears, to want to kind of cut us off it, from it. So I'm not sure how much we can rely on that, which actually brings me to the second point, which I have enormous sympathy. In fact, 1 year wouldn't be a bad idea. The present proposals to cap propose you to cap you retrospectively after you've already made the offers. And I know that this, again, is a common threat, because it's not just the private providers. I mean, this is the first time we've been subjected to it, but our public sector providers have suffered this already for a couple of years, of being told after the event what they should have done.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul?
Yeah, I think the first question, if you look at the independent sector, historically there have probably been too many providers of unregulated provision, and I think that's been part of the historical problem that we're still living with now. I think so long as everybody is meeting the standards and playing by the rules and properly licensed, accredited, etc., then no, I would suggest there aren't too many providers, and we probably need more. I think I would equate that as well to the university sector. You would have to ask the question whether 120-plus universities is appropriate for a country of this size, and whether all those universities should be delivering 100 and whatever it is, 20-plus courses and trying to be specialists and everything. So I think the fact that we have a very static university sector where nobody's allowed to fail is a fundamental problem. And then quickly on the second point, Sue, about planning, the only way to get away from that is to reduce the amount of centralization in education. And so long as we have a centralized planning structure, you're always going to have that problem. And if we really want to get long-term investment and long-term planning and meet the long-term needs of students, then I think the sector has to be decentralized. And I think you have to put some more trust and empowerment, if you like, back into those providers who've got track records of quality provision.
Finally, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the points have been made, and just to echo, there's lots of providers, but there's very little choice. There's this kind of pervading Henry Ford approach to degrees that you can have any you like as long as it's 3-year and residential. Yeah. And echoing something Alice said, yes, there is a risk of a high-profile private sector failure, but equally there's a risk of a high-profile public sector failure as well. And I think, you know, that risk is not specific to our sector.
Yes. The reason I'm worried particularly about a private sector one is that if there is a public sector one, I agree, and it could do grave damage, as we saw with London Met's problems with the UK Border Agency and the effects outside the country. But it's just that in this very early stage, when we are still a very small part of it, it seems to me that the government reaction to a private sector serious failure could be very nasty indeed, and make life incredibly difficult for us, and actually just cut off the chance of creating the variety that we're saying is needed in the sector.
I've got I'll come out to the audience once more, but actually in terms of kind of formulating a second round of questions, I'll throw something around failure actually to the panel as well. But are there any final sort of comments or questions that you'd like to make before we kind of wrap this up? Gina, if you wouldn't mind again, just thanks.
Hi, I'm Gina Hobson. I'm the Chief Executive of the British Accreditation Council. I'm interested, sort of, I think, what's talked about at the end there, and also in Professor Alcock's presentation, around the issue of size of the private sector being one of the things that will potentially sort of embed it that bit more and secure it against those reputational threats that could come along with a closure. I mean, does the panel think that there are other things aside from the size of the sector that are going to be important in terms of that security and reputation? Mm.
And I'll fulfil my... Are there any other final comments or questions? No? OK. Well, I'll fulfil my threat or promise to ask a question on failure. And And what I want to ask is, has the fact that they're, you know, in reality not really, hasn't really been a public failure, whether because public policy perhaps hasn't allowed it, or because maybe the scenario just hasn't arisen, whether that is a good or a bad thing in terms of allowing the sector to move forward in a way in which it could or should. There's an obvious answer around what that would mean for the students at that particular institution in this kind of imaginary scenario, and I don't think anyone would say that that's likely to be a good thing. But I'm just talking about the kind of the principle of institutions that are successful or allowed to grow to the extent they are, and those that are not successful being allowed to kind of be kept along, kind of just bumping along. I'm just interested in people's views on that, and I'll start with Ben.
Yeah, thanks for that, Aaron. I guess it's difficult to say, really. I mean, the consequences of failure are so dramatic, it's difficult to talk about them kind of glibly. I guess what I would say is that if you're a private sector institution, you have to have a failure contingency plan built into your kind of strategy right from the very start, so that in that nightmare scenario that a private sector institution does go to the wall, there's a kind of programmed end game for the students in which there wouldn't necessarily be in the kind of zero sum scenario that a public institution is allowed to fail. I guess in terms of answering the question, I guess I come back to my earlier point, really, that these risks aren't specific to one sector. And in terms of the consequences of a failure of a big institution in each, I think the perception of a failure in our sector would indeed be graver. But that kind of illustrates the general perception that problems are peculiar to the private sector in a way that they're not, foreign students being the classic example with London Met, etc.
Thanks very much. Cool.
I have a problem with this concept of no failure is allowed. I mean, most of us are brought up to understand that making mistakes and failing is part of the learning process. So if nobody's failing, then we're not learning very much. And I think if you have a system which is predicated upon institutions are not allowed to fail for whatever reason, then that can't be in the interests of the students. And
do you think that's I kind of posed it in the question, but do you think it's fair to then accept that failure isn't allowed? Do you think that's currently existing in the system?
Well, can you name a university that's been allowed to fail, that has failed, that's gone out of existence in the last how many years?
Well, of course, we talk about failure. There have been private sector institutions that had to go into the state sector to avoid failure. That's been one of the ways it's been avoided up till now.
Yeah, but it's surely not beyond the wit of the sector to devise whether it's a contingency plan, or businesses have contingency plans, whether it's an insurance policy, whether it's formal agreements with other institutions to take students. It's surely not beyond our capabilities to devise those schemes, but I come back to the fundamental problem. If there is no fear of failure, then you will have a culture of complacency, which cannot be in the interests of the key stakeholders.
No, I agree. I think that the system should allow failure. My worry is purely a practical one. I prefer it to be a public sector one that fails first. because at least it shows there that it is indeed not particular to the private sector. There are certainly one or two quite close candidates, I suspect, at the moment. But whether the government at the end of the day will have the nerve to allow it to happen publicly. I mean, it can happen, obviously, quietly, privately, if it forces mergers, rather like building societies, not failing in that sense. But, of course, in one sense, the problem with that is that if it's not demonstrated, half the value of the failure goes.
Yeah, I mean, the press and the various lobby groups from the established sector are very quick to jump on private provision, particularly if it's for-profit provision. The part of the equation they miss is the risk that is being taken by the individuals who are putting up the capital for those enterprises. And that risk does not exist in a traditional university model. And so it's a very unbalanced discussion, and I come back to the point that failure has to be part of a progressive, dynamic system which is future-proofing itself. And if it doesn't exist, it's static.
there was a danger of kind of lots of consensus. I suspected this question might help to ensure that that wasn't the case entirely. And on that basis, I'll give the final word to Andy.
I think two things quickly. I mean, I think failure is a problem for all of us, actually. I mean, if you go back to the international issue, and very much if you talk to Alan Langlands at Hefke, you know, his concern is how do we create a system-wide, and he means wide, a mechanism that sort of allows us to both insure against, you know, the reputational kind of impact of that, as well as the individual impact as far as kind of, you know, particular students and learners and investors are concerned. So I think there's something, you know, handling it is something we're all responsible for. And I think in India, it's not going to make a great deal of difference if it's a for-profit, a not-for-profit or public, if they're a big recruiter of Indian students, for example. So that should be something that unites us. I just make the point, which I think is important, is that the public sector isn't very static, and neither is the public sector particularly, you know, kind of monolithic. Lots of institutions in the public sector that don't exist anymore. Lots of change over the last 20 years. If you just look at the Hefke list of approved institutions or kind of who's members of UCAS over the last kind of 20, 30 years, you'll see quite significant changes. You know, specialists going into large institutions, specialists coming out of large institutions, just two examples. And I think, you know, and it's already been mentioned that, you know, it is a problem that there are misconceptions of the private sector, but there are also kind of problems about kind of misunderstanding the public sector. And I think, you know, the truth is that they are more similar than we think, and it's a very, very kind of broad market across public and private. And as I said at the start, I think that's going to complicate and evolve still further, actually. But, you know, finish with Alan's lines, really, which is failure would hit us all managing it.
Yeah. And I think that's a fair assessment. Yes, I doubt there's a real ability to kind of properly distinguish between, you know, what sort of provider. I don't think most people would understand the complex legal structures of institutions, or indeed their differences, and I suspect the impact would be significant. And ultimately, my sense that even a kind of a sort of a Tory government on its own that might allow other institutions to go to the wall elsewhere, I still don't think even a kind of a pretty right-wing market forces Tory government would allow an institution to go to the wall because of the impact on the students that would be at the institution at that time, and indeed the generations of alumni at that institution. So that's not to say they wouldn't enforce management, take management changes or mergers and so on, but it's something that I think that's being thought about in both the kind of the public and private, if they're even fair distinction, spheres of higher education. Right, can I just, yes, I was pleased to throw that grenade in at the end, so quietly patting myself on the back. But more importantly, could you ask not just a pat on the back of the four speakers that really have made the first session, but I could ask you just to give them a round of applause, please.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.